Hey, next on the T Nation, thanks for coming back and tuning in to part two of this week's special Happy Birthday to Me episode of the show. In this part, I am joined by 1983 PGA champion and two-time players champion, Hal Sutton, and former PGA Tour player turned fantastic analyst, Frank Nobilo. Both guys have come to mean a great deal to me. They have been wonderful guests over the years on this show. They have also become wonderful friends on top of that. We continue the conversation on this year's Masters Tournament and what it's like to play in a Masters. We also look ahead to the PGA Championship at Valhalla and the U.S. Open at Pinehurst. Both guys share fantastic insights, so sit back, relax, enjoy the conversation, and let us take your mind off everything else going on in your life for the next hour. Before we get started, I want to remind you about our friends over at 2Under. 2Under men's performance briefs are the unofficial underwear of the PGA, Ryder Cup, and President's Cup teams, and are sold in over 3,000 golf pro shops and golf specialty retailers nationwide. Ricky Fowler is their global ambassador, and over 50 other PGA, Korn Ferry, and Champions Tour players wear them. Just to mention a few, they are David Toms, Jerry Kelly, Justin Thomas, William McGirt, Scott McCarron, and Chris DeMarco. The Joey Pouch technology provides the ultimate male asset management, delivering maximum comfort from the tee box to the boardroom to the bedroom. Go to 2under.com to check out the bundle specials that offer substantial discounts for being a Next on the Tee listener. That's the number 2, UNDR.com. 2Under, performance in your pants.
Every January, PGA Tour Superstore pros meet every manufacturer, learn about the latest equipment, log thousands of hours of training, and together hit over 100,000 balls, all so they can get you the perfect fit.
All right, now back in Next on the Tee with me is a guy who's become another wonderful friend, somebody else I greatly admire, and that is PGA Tour legend Hal Sutton. He is a great follow on Twitter at Hal Sutton Golf. For those of you who haven't joined me before when he has been a part of the show and may not remember what a great playing career Hal had, let me give you a quick reminder of it. He was named the 1980 College Player of the Year. He won 14 times during his college career at Centenary in Louisiana. He was a two-time All-American, and he led Centenary to the NCAA tournament. He was a two-time Trans-American Athletic Conference Player of the Year. And he won the 1980 U.S. Amateur Championship. He turned pro in 81, got his first win out on tour at the 1982 Walt Disney World Classic. And that year, he was named the Tour's Rookie of the Year. In 83, he was named the PGA Player of the Year after winning the Players' Championship and the PGA Championship. In 1998, he won the Tour Championship here in Atlanta. He famously beat Tiger by a stroke at the 2000 Players' Championship. He captained the 2004 U.S. Ryder Cup team, and he backed up his 14 college wins with 14 more out on the PGA Tour. He finished second 18 times. He had 135 top 10s and 239 top 25s, and he should be in the World Golf Hall of Fame. And I couldn't be more thrilled he is back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Al, thanks for coming back on the show.
I'm good, Chris. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Thank you. So, Hal, I know you're putting the finishing touches on a golf course that I fully expect to be named Best New Private Course in America very soon. Give us an update on how things are coming at Darmore.
Oh, it's coming awesome. Every day I go out there, it just gets better and better. And, you know, it's a very traditional golden age golf architecture golf course. I followed C.B. McDonald and Seth Rainer's, what they believed, and I put several template holes out there, and our clubhouse and lodging is followed. Bill Curtis, who's the architect here in Houston, followed William Wershner, who was turn of the century architect in California, who did Alistair McKenzie's house at Pasta Tiempo and Marion Holland's house. And it's just everything we've done has historical value and very traditional, no GPSs and everything else out there. It's like getting in a time machine and going back 30 years, playing the game the way we used to play it. And I'm so proud of us being able to do this.
So no GPS out there. So I'm guessing you went all old school and we've got 150-yard bushes and things like that to walk off the yardages?
Yeah, well, we have the markers in the center of the fairway, 250, the 200, the 150, and the 100, you know, red, white, blue, and yellow. And, you know, it's everybody's got a rangefinder, so they can figure that out. We'll have some caddies that'll be able to help people out. But, you know, I went back. I learned how to play the game on the golf course. You know, I grew up on a little nine-hole golf course, and it wasn't very busy, and I played 45 holes a day, and that's where I really learned how to play the game. And today, golf is, you know, I heard y'all talking that, you know, the ratings are down and people are finding other things to do, but golf courses are really busy right now, and you can't really, you know, hit three or four drivers off of a certain hole, or you can't hit two or three iron shots into a hole. And at Darmore, you're going to be able to do that. And we've had several people join just because of that reason. They know it's not going to be busy and they'll be able to do that.
Like we mentioned last time, you've got some cabins on the course that are very similar to the ones at Augusta National. Talk about the other amenities that are going to be available there.
Well, they're not really cabins. They're lodging. There's the first set of lodges have eight rooms in them, but it's I don't know that I can even explain it. It's unique. It looks like one big facility, but all the rooms you enter from the outside, although it looks like one complex. You know, we built a 22,000 square foot putting course right out front of the cabins, and you know, it's going to be lit at night, so I suspect that there'll be a lot of guys out there testing their putting skills against one another. One of the things I intend to do is to implement match play competition. I love match play competition. We don't do it enough. It keeps everybody in the game, even if you have a bad hole. And, you know, that's the way we originally played the game. I brought Nick Holligan in, who grew up in Edinburgh and was at Renaissance in Scotland, and he's our director of golf. And Sandy Armour, who is strong vintage, I've known him forever. He's, you know, not much younger than me, and we've been around the world and back together and playing professional golf, and he's going to be our head pro. And I mean, if you work at Darmore, you can be assured you must know golf at a deep level. And you know, I just feel like Texas was ready for this. And, you know, I think it's going to be one of the top golf courses in Texas when it's said and done.
I'm sure it's going to be one of the top golf courses on the planet. And I can't wait to see it at the top of the list of the best new private courses in the country. So I'm sure that's going to be in magazines very, very soon.
Well, I put my all into it. I moved over here a year and a half ago, and every day that we've been designing the golf course, I've been there. So I mean, if I didn't like something the day before, it was changed the next day. And, you know, I would say I showed it to a guy the other day who was really a good player. And he said, I just couldn't understand links in Texas, a links course in Texas, until I see this. He said, you know, the best part about it is it's got a backdrop of trees. It's got exceptional trees on the property, but yet it does look like a links style golf course. So, and then I had Matt Swartz, who was at Carmargo for a while in Cincinnati, who was, some people say it's Seth Rayner's very best golf course. And I said to Matt after he viewed it, I said, so do you think Seth Rayner would have been proud of what I've done here? Or do you think he would have been, you know, disappointed? And he said, Hal, from the moment I drove in the gate, I felt like I was at Carmargo. So I'm telling you, Seth Rayner would love. Wow. So that was as good a compliment as I could get. So
yeah, good for you. Hal, switching gears a little bit. And speaking of Augusta National, we just watched Scottie Scheffler win his second Masters tournament. What'd you think about what you saw from him over the week?
Well, I think he's the new Tiger Woods. He's very dominant, you know. And one thing that I really like about Scottie Scheffler, he plays golf. He doesn't play golf swing. You know, he has a distinctive look in action, and he's in his own world. He's not marching to the beat of others' rules, and I admire that about him. And, you know, so many people they think there's only one way to swing a golf club, and you know that consequently everybody's looking alike these days, but certainly not Scottie Scheffler. And he's proven that he's very dominant on the golf course, and you know, he played great.
When many of the other players were falling apart in the second and third rounds due to the windy conditions, he was one under par for those days. Do you think, being from Texas, where you guys frequently get a lot of high winds, did that give him an advantage over the rest of the field?
Well, it certainly didn't hurt. And, you know, I think so many people, when the wind blows, they feel defeated before they even start. And, you know, Scottie Scheffler looked up and saw the wind blowing. And he says, hey, today could be my day. And, you know, you can tell when people feel disadvantaged by wind or conditions. And, you know, they set themselves up for defeat by attitude before they even play. And he certainly had it under control.
Another guy who impressed me during the tournament was Ludvig Åberg. He was born on Halloween in 1999 and may soon be a nightmare for the rest of the tour. I mean, he's just 24 years old, played his college golf there in Texas at Texas Tech, won multiple awards as a top college golfer, was ranked the number one amateur for 29 weeks. It's not only his first Masters, but it's also his first major. But he looked like he was enjoying every moment out there, even after he double bogeyed 11 on Sunday. What'd you think about this kid's play?
Well, I think he's certainly going to be a great player. I saw him play when he was in college here in Houston. I felt like then he was going to be, you know, a fabulous player, and certainly showed that this last weekend. I think he's going to be heard from many times. To me, he looked very controlled. He looked like he had it under control. In his mind, he looked confident and under control. So,
Hal, when we look ahead to the next major, the PGA Championship at Valhalla, you played in a couple of PGA Championships there back in 96 and 2000. What do you recall about the golf course and what it's like playing a major there?
It's a good golf course. You know, it's a Nicklaus golf course, so it's kind of got that look. The back nine is pretty stout. You know, Tiger won there. Bob May almost won there. I think what that says by bringing that up is two different style players had a good tournament that week. So, you know, I don't think it's necessarily a course that you have to be super long, although they probably lengthened it since I was there. But I think it, you know, it lends itself to different style play can succeed there.
Speaking of the PGA, when you won it in 1983, it was held at Riviera Country Club outside of L.A. Your idol, Jack Nicklaus, making a charge at you in the final round. He started six strokes back, shot 66 in that final round. You had a big lead in the tournament the week before, so that was coming with you and carrying over into this tournament. You get that big lead going into the final round. You bogey 12, 13, and 14. You had to talk with yourself to make sure that same thing didn't happen again that week. Talk about that.
Well, you know, the week before I had a six-shot lead at Anheuser-Busch going into the final round, and I did, honestly, I mean, this, I don't mean this in an arrogant way, but at the time I was playing so well, I didn't think anybody could spot me six shots in the world and come back and beat me. But Calvin Pete beat me at the Anheuser-Busch, and, you know, not to take away from his play, but I certainly played poorly, and that's why he was able to win. And, you know, it embarrassed me. I came home. I went to work on my game. Felt like what I had done that caused that was more mental than physical, and had something to prove when I went back out to Riviera. And I opened up with 65 and followed with 66 and had built up a decent lead and ended up having, I don't remember if I had a one or two shot lead going into Sunday, but anyway, I had four shot lead going into the back nine, and then I bogeyed 12, 13, and 14 to have a one shot lead. And this whole time, Nicklaus is, you know, this is before we had electronic scoreboards and things like that. So I don't know exactly what he's doing, but I can hear from the crowd that it's Nicholas and he's burning it up. The bear was roaring. And, you know, I think maybe the scoring official or somebody that had some know-how said that I had a one-shot lead. And I remember telling Freddie when I got on the 15th tee, Freddie's my caddy, give me the towel. I'm burning up with sweat. I buried my head in the towel and I said, you cannot, I'm talking to myself, you cannot let this happen again. This will determine who you are. This will identify, you'll be identified with blowing leads. And I said, so all I can do is hit the next tee shot. And all I want to do is just hit it down there in the fairway. And then I'll go down and play the next shot. And so literally what I did is I talked myself into doing what I tried to do all the time, but which was play one shot at a time. But I literally had to do that. And, you know, it made me, I got in with four par, ended up winning the golf tournament by one. But anyway, it got me into the clubhouse. One shot at a time. I would appeal to everybody out there listening that there is better golf if you don't play the shot you just played. And if you don't play the shot you're going to play in the future, just play the one right there at hand.
Jack was waiting for you on 18 to see if you could finish off the win, which was a dream of yours to have him there when you won a tournament, particularly a major tournament. Then he got up and said a few words at the trophy presentation, and he said that you asked him how to handle it when you're coming up the 18th hole needing a par to win. And he said, I hope you get used to it because you're going to have it a lot. You're going to have the opportunity to win a lot is what I believe he was alluding to. Then he went on to say, you're a fine player, a fine young man, and we're all very proud to have your name on the PGA Trophy. What did it mean to have your hero stand up and say those kinds of things?
Well, you know, as you said, it was a dream of mine to be able to, you know, play against him in a major championship, much less beat him. But, you know, everybody asked me if I was nervous about that on the last hole, the last shot. And I said, not really, because I had done it 1,000 times at that little 9-hole golf course that I was telling you about earlier. And I had beat him every time in my mind. So I felt like I could do it one more time. But anyway, you know, to have him say a lot of kind things about me and was, you know, that was also a dream come true. And, you know, I had the pleasure. I was on the 87 Ryder Cup team when we played at Muirfield, which is his course. And I stayed in the house with he and Barbara the whole week. He was the captain of the team. And, you know, I really got to know Jack on a much more personal level at that time. And I had a great deal of respect for him before that, but then much more respect for him after the fact, and got to know Barbara quite, you know, a lot better because of that too. So, you know, it was a dream come true to be able to stay in the house with my idol, you know, during the Ryder Cup.
Hal, before I let you go, let our listeners know again, how can they stay up to date with all the great things you're out there doing, whether it's following you online or it's on social media?
You know, Hal Sutton Golf on Twitter. I'm not as active as I used to be on that. But you know, emails hal@darmore.com. That's what I do every day. And that's the easiest way if someone needed to contact me. Anyway.
Well, Hal, I can't thank you enough. I know you're very busy trying to get the finishing touches on Darmore. Again, it's going to be one of the great new golf courses in our country. I can't thank you enough for coming back and being generous with your time. You're absolutely one of my all-time favorites, my friend.
Well, thanks, Chris. And happy birthday later this week. I've got a birthday later this month. And
yes, you do.
So you're an April baby, so you must. I know you're a great guy. So we share something in common.
There you go.
Well, happy birthday.
Same to you. I look forward to catching up with you again soon, Hal.
All right, Chris.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
That's the great Hal Sutton, folks. Just one of the great people you get to meet in this life. And go out there and check out Darmore. If you haven't, you got to go see this place. This golf course, and I'm not saying just because Hal's a friend and Hal's been a part of the show as many times as he has, because this golf course, just like he said about some of the other people that have already started to give him some feedback, is going to be just one of the great golf courses in our country. And at some point, I got to believe that the PGA Tour will be stopping there to do something, whether it's the Houston, Open or whatever it is. This golf course is going to host some really great events in the not too distant future. And like I say, Hal is just one of my favorite people on the planet. He just couldn't be nicer to me and more accommodating. I've had him on the show, I think 13 times now. And I'm already looking forward to number 14. A great guy and a great now course designer and a guy who should be in the World Golf Hall of Fame. Coming up next is a guy who finished in the top 10 in all four majors back in the mid to late 90s. And he is now one of the all-time great golf analysts. And that's Frank Nobilo. Before I bring Frank in, let's talk about our friends over at Squares Golf. And folks, do you sway and you're off balance in your golf swing? You know what? It could be your shoes. A golf shoe needs structure to provide stability and reduce sway. How can you tell if your shoes lack structure and are hurting your game? If you can hold your shoes by the toe and heel and twist it, toss it. Squares was designed for the perfect balance of structure and comfort. Isn't it time you tried Squares? Try the new Speed Bolt at squares.com. That's squairz.com.
Frustrated with your golf game? Imagine playing with total confidence. Join me, LPGA Pro and golf mindset expert Debbie O'Connell, for my Conquer Your Golf Mind Challenge. Bill cuts 6 strokes and Lori is club champion. What's your goal? Click the link or text NEXT to 727-339-0106. Use code NEXT for $20 off. Your tee time for transformation is now. Will you take the shot?
It is a huge privilege to round out this very special Happy Birthday to Me edition of Next on the Tee with my next guest, Frank Nobilo. Frank has come to mean a lot to me, thanks to his generosity and what a great guest he has been over the years. I want to remind you a little bit about his background. At the age of 18, he won the New Zealand Amateur Championship, becoming the second youngest player to ever to win that title. He turned pro in 1979. Got his first professional win at the 1982 New South Wales PGA Championship. He won the New Zealand PGA Championship twice in 1985 and 1987. He joined the European Tour in 85 and got his first win on that tour at the 1988 PLM Open. Frank won 14 times around the world, including 2 Sarasin World Opens and the 1997 Greater Greensboro Classic. He played on 3 International President's Cup teams. In the mid-90s, he recorded top 10 finishes in all 4 majors. He joined the Golf Channel in 2004 and was a lead analyst for their PGA Tour coverage, plus their in-studio shows Golf Central and Live From. He's now knocking it out of the park as an analyst for CBS Sports, and I couldn't be more honored. I get to have him back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Frank, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you very much, but more importantly, happy birthday in advance.
I appreciate that very much, my friend. So, Frank, great job as always calling the Masters. You make the show infinitely more fun to watch. Talk about your impressions about what you saw in this year's tournament.
It was great. It was interesting just listening to the tail end of Hal, because I think he nailed it. The analogy I would give, too, with Scottie Scheffler, there's a little bit of Johnny Miller in him. You know, Johnny Miller had that innate ability to know where the face was when it was hitting the ball. That's why he could hit so many great iron shots. Scotty sort of does the same thing. You know, distance control is excellent. But the other thing that Hal brought up that we're trying to talk about last week, in some respects, was the ability to hit a shot without worrying about the result. And that's easy to say, but it's so hard to do when there's the prospect of perhaps winning a Masters on the line. And if you go back and sort of rewatch what happens at the Masters last week, especially in the weekend, in holes like 13 and 15, Scottie Scheffler, it didn't matter if he was in front or chasing, he still tried to hit the right shot in the right situation, irrespective of where that shot came off. That is so hard to do. But other people backed down on some of those shots. He never did.
The playing conditions on Friday and Saturday were difficult. The winds were crazy. Last year, we had the cold and the rain in the middle rounds. Have you seen it play more difficult than it has in the last 2 years?
No, to be honest, because the greens were firm. Coming in on the practice rounds for the players, the greens were very dry. That was going to be the defense for the golf course. And then because the wind came in, and it was legit 40-mile-an-hour gusts at times, So for the layman, that's a four club breeze at times. So what you would normally hit an eight iron, for example, you're contemplating hitting a four iron or at least a five iron into the green. And also it would buff it. So if it dropped down, then you just emailed the green. If it stood up again, then you finished up short. So you could see the frustration. And at Augusta, you've got to land the ball in such a small area, because if you pitch it on a downslope, the ball kicks forward. If you misjudge, pitch it on an upslope, it doesn't kick forward. So you're trying to control the ball through the air, and you're trying to, you know, fixate on a landing spot. And that's why that attitude is so important, because if you get that gust of wind and you miss the spot, you can't do it any other way. And so to answer your question, no, I thought Thursday, you know, they got a little bit of a reprieve because of the rain, but there wasn't as much rain as they anticipated. You know, we were playing catch up there on Friday morning, and the course, you know, the greens were still incredibly firm. So they just never got a chance really to play the sort of target golf that they like to play.
I always enjoy seeing some of the older champions play well there. Last year with Fred Couples making the cut at 63 years of age. This year, Vijay made it at age 61, as did Jose Maria Olazabal. He did it at 58. For those of us who go way back, we remember 1998 when Jack Nicklaus not only made the cut at age 58, but finished tied for sixth that year. What is it about Augusta National that allows some of the great champions to continue to be competitive very late into their careers? What is it you think about Augusta National that allows some of the great champions to continue to be competitive there very late into their careers?
The fact that it's not straightforward. I remember playing with Arnold Palmer in the second round, the first ever Masters that I played at. And I would look at a hole, and I'm looking like 5 or 10 feet left or right of the flag. And, you know, Mr. Palmer would hit one, and it would start like 30 feet away. And I'm like, well, you know, that's a bit weird. And then I'd watch the ball land and gather and take a slope. And then lo and behold, the ball would finish about 15 feet away. And he did that not just on one occasion, but on countless holes. So to answer your question, some of the older players, they know the alternative route into just about every hole. For example, the seventh hole, the shape of that green, if you watch there when they stick the flag just over the bunker on the right, you can actually hit it past the flag, probably a good 10 or 15 feet, and 10 or 15 feet left of the flag, and the ball will nearly go in. 14 is another example of knowing where to land the ball. So it's the only major, stating the obvious, that has the same venue. So they've seen that movie over and over again. And they also know the value of the score. For example, an Ola Tharball would have known that the cut was going to keep going up in numbers. It looked like it was going to be 3 over at the start of Friday, and it continued to increase, and then all of a sudden it was 6 over. So they have a better indication of what the real true score is going to be.
Frank, we've seen Scotty now win his second green jacket, along with being the first guy to win back-to-back players' championships. He's got to be the favorite going into the other three majors this year. Do you think he adds a third or maybe even a fourth major to his resume this year?
You would think so, the way he's playing. The only thing that's going to stop him is probably the impending birth of his first child. I don't see any other reason. He's learning to putt and chip appreciably better. He's now confident. You know, when you've got 3 wins out of your last 4 starts, it's amazing. There's not a single player in the game right now. I would have actually included Victor Hovland. If Hovland hadn't changed coaches and we saw the same sort of form at the end of last year, you'd say, well, Hovland's been playing really good, but Scheffler's back to where he was. Or Rory was doing the same thing. Well, Hovland's gone backwards, Rory's gone backwards, and Scotty's actually pushed the chains forward. But, you know, it'll be interesting at Valhalla, because the last time they played there was the August 8th. And also the Ryder Cup, I remember being there for that. I remember when I played there in 1996, was also the August 8th. So I've never seen it play in May, for example. I don't know if it means it plays firmer or more bounce. I know Scotty Scheffler will do all right purely because he hits the ball better than anybody else. And that's what we were saying going into this week. If he putts half decent, it's game over. And he's just such a consistent level week in, week out, yet to shoot a score over par this season. So it means he's in the mix. There's no two ways about it. Very Tiger-like, but that doesn't mean you're unbeatable. And Scotty's aware of that. That's the other thing. It's not like he goes, hey, beat me if you can. He's aware of the fact that he needs his A game, and he brings it. So it's a guy in the prime of his career, 27, with the right attitude to match.
Speaking of Tiger, we saw him set the consecutive cuts made record this year at Augusta National. And I think people were encouraged with how well he played Thursday and early on Friday, but that's contrasted about how he struggled from almost the moment he came back out to finish his second round on Saturday. Based on what you've seen from him, not only this week, but maybe over the last 12 months, what are your expectations about his ability to win a tournament going forward?
To use his terminology, Chris, you know, he needs reps. He played 23 holes. He withdrew on the sixth hole at Riviera in the second round. That was it. I know he played in his event in was it November, December, and the father and son, but you know, that was on a flat track. It certainly wasn't on a hilly golf course. And we just don't see him play. I thought what he did on Friday was quite incredible. Shooting 72. Remember, there's only one score in the 60s. There's only about four or five guys that shot a lower score on Friday. And he did that with a short game. It was guts and guile. It was amazing. I'm always impressed with someone that gets the most out of the game. And that was just as impressive as some of the 65s he shot. You know, when his body's been fitting well and he's been able to swing the club the way he wants to and he can putt. I thought 72, given a body that's been repaired so many different times, no golf, I thought that was an incredible score. And I think when he went into Saturday, to be perfectly honest, I know he said he's there to win and all that, but I think deep down, and maybe one day he'll tell us, but I think deep down it really was, the goal really was to shoot to make that record, 24 straight cuts. And beat out Gary Player and Fred Couples. I think that would have been a realistic goal, and he achieved that. I don't fault him for what happened in the weekend. Just not enough golf. Hadn't played four rounds for a long, long period of time, especially in windy conditions with bone dry greens and fast. I just think even for Tiger Woods, that's too much to expect. Going forward, I still don't know. Question mark. I think I don't know if he's Valhalla's a little easier to walk. I know you go back to 2001 when he beat Bob May. That kept the slam alive. So it's another place he has great memories, but I think it's a young player's course. I really do. I think it's length is going to be a big advantage at Valhalla.
Frank, we talked a little bit about this last time, but the ratings for PGA Tour golf this year are down about 20%. Ratings for the Masters, you know, depending on what you believe, Sportico is saying it's down about 20%. I'm not sure if they're including all of the streaming numbers or not. But when we see that PGA Tour golf television ratings are down, people are pointing to fans being tired of the fighting between LIV and the PGA Tour. They're also talking about some of the casual fans that used to come into our game to watch Tiger. Now that he doesn't play very often, they've started tuning out. You talked last time about how ratings for volleyball around the world are higher than golf. Talk about what do we need? What needs to happen? Or can something happen to get more people back to tuning into the tournaments from week to week?
Well, you can blame me because I've been on some of those shows. So maybe. I'm trying to buy a little time. It's tough. And you know, I'm glad you mentioned what I said last time, because sometimes we think our game is bigger than what it really is. You know, we have an amazing game because it's one of the few sports where most people that watch actually play. Recreational golf on one hand has gone up, which is huge. Golf should pat itself on the back for that. That the fact that more players are playing, we came out of COVID and the game was healthy. But I think professional golfers, it doesn't matter what tour they play, whether it's LIV or PGA Tour, I think they need to look in the mirror. And, you know, it's been a chase for money. And I think that's turned people off. You look what's happened over the last 4 or 5 years, the economy around the world, we've got wars, we've got all sorts of things going on. You know, people struggling to put their kids through school, you know, the real world. So if people are going to argue and fight about money or no cuts and expect a handout, I don't think that's very palatable for people of today. The players of yesteryear, and I'm not trying to, you know, date myself or those or say that, you know, say they're any better than what they were, but I really think the game came first and they realized they were fortunate to play for a living. And a lot of them did very handsomely. But it seems to me it's like money first, game second. And I honestly think that's putting some people off. These guys are tremendous, but they're either being led that way, whether it's agents or the PGA Tour or whether it's LIV or whatever. They're putting the cart before the horse. And the average person, the ones that I talk to and I respect, because as I've said, even as an announcer, you ask the person in the bar or the person in the street, if they've got the time and they stop you, I say, what do you think? You know, what do you like about the coverage? What do you don't like about the coverage? What do you like about the game? What do you don't like about the game? And almost to a man, they are sick of the fight. They go, you know, I'd rather go and watch something else. Golf is not a boxing fight. It's not them against us, but that's what it is right now. And it's sad. I actually thought the Masters, to be honest, I was hoping that it would be, people would just be, here we go. What a huge relief. We can just watch golf. And, you know, I know we don't have all the other streaming figures and all that, but in some respects, the people that count, and I said that last time, the viewers, I think they voice their opinion. And I just think they deserve to be listened to.
100% agree with that. You mentioned Valhalla and previous tournaments there. The PGA Championship was there in 1996 when you played. You finished tied for eighth that week. What do you remember about being in contention back in 96 there?
Well, I do remember Kenny Perry sitting up in the tower for a while, that's for sure. And then Mark Brooks. It was fun. I'd never played there before. I was still playing in Europe at the time. I liked the fact that I think I played with Calc actually the first couple of rounds by memory. Now just popped in my head. So we had some fun. I always enjoyed playing with him actually. But yeah, it was a little more like target golf then because it was the August date. So you're coming out of summertime. So a lot of those Bermuda greens, you know, they've been syringed with water to keep them going. So it was very much target golf, but It was fairly straightforward. It was enjoyable. I'd never been to Kentucky before. I actually thought it was fun because it's a fairly new golf course. But now they've been back there many a time for other PGA championships as well as a Ryder Cup. And really the last memory is Rory just finishing in daylight. But the way in which he drove the ball, and that's why I said I think it's power dependent, especially that back nine. If you can drive the ball well, then the par fives become reachable, 11 and 18. Some of those par fours that are key, you can get it past those bunkers, and then the golf course really does lend itself to you. Shorter hitters, it becomes a much bigger golf course. But yeah, it's a good test. It'll be very scoreable. They'll shoot some good numbers.
Frank, I noticed you didn't play in the U.S. Open at Pinehurst in 2005 after having played in the previous five U.S. Opens, and playing it again in 2000. Was there an injury in 99? Why didn't you play that year?
Yeah, that's a good question. I actually can't remember, to be honest, because I know that's when I was suffering with inflammatory polyarthritis. So I think I actually might have gone to the Mayo that year, and that's when the form started to dip, to be brutally honest.
Have you played that golf course before?
Pinehurst, no. I never got to play Pinehurst. And I remember watching Michael Campbell. I actually... working in TV when he won, I remember going into the locker room and seeing him when he had the trophy. Martin Keimer when he won as well. So, yeah, I never got to play any of the Pinehurst courses. So that's sort of a regret. There's, you always think you're going to play courses that are on your wish list, and that's one that I never got to see. I think it's marvelous because, to me, it was like an inland links. I love some of the features in that. I think it's a great tee to green golf course. There was some beautiful driving holes. Well, there is some beautiful driving holes there. So it would have been, I think it's a golf course if you're playing well, you really enjoy it because it's another golf course that separates you. Good players get rewarded. I mean, it's quite simple. You're rewarding good play and you're punishing poor play. Not every golf course is like that. You know, that's why Augusta continually tries to make its changes. As the equipment goes, as the driver's easier to hit, you know, Augusta makes those tweaks where they're trying to make you play a little bit better. And that's why, despite all these crazy conditions, as I was saying before, if you go back and rewatch some of the key holes, Jack Nicklaus always said there were six shots you had to hit, right? Tom Watson talked about it earlier in the week. You know, tee shot at 2, second into 11, tee shot at 12, drive and second at 13, second shot into 15. Go back and watch Scottie Scheffler play those shots and the rest of the field, and you'll see why he won.
Speaking of playing again, I saw your post on social media that you got your first new set of irons in many years. Talk about that.
Yes, I played my best golf with Mizuno's. I'm not trying to make a plug. I'm not with any manufacturer. And it'd been a while and all that. And I said to my wife, who's here with me this week at Hilton Head, you know, I just sort of had these sort of not nightmares, dreams. I thought, you know, I want to start hitting some more balls in that and you know, health feels all right. I'm like, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it the way I want to do it. I'm going to do it with clubs that I used to like or a brand I used to like. So I went and saw the guys in on the West Coast swing, chatted a little bit, looked at some clubs. We put them together and I got them and I hit them. I must admit, I'm not exactly swinging like I'd like to right now, but it's a step in the right direction. It was fun. I enjoyed it. You know, when it, sometimes you can't, I don't take clubs with me because the job is to talk about everybody else. So I don't want to spend my time hitting balls out there on a working week, but when I'm home now, you know, I live on a golf course. I'd like to get out there and hit a few more. I really would.
Frank, one more before I let you go. And we've talked about this in the past, but as you know, the show is now a part of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review in my hometown of Pittsburgh. And you played in the 1994 U.S. Open, which was played that year at Oakmont. After the first round, you were tied with Jack Nicklaus, Hale Irwin, and Ernie Els, one back of Tom Watson. After the third round, you were still right there, second alone, two back of Ernie. That was also Mr. Palmer's final U.S. Open appearance there in his backyard. What do you remember about that tournament and really just being around the city of Pittsburgh that week?
Well, I loved it. Have I told you the story about Arnold Palmer in the press building?
I don't think so. Tell us again if you have.
Yeah, you know, a little preamble thing. You know, I grew up in New Zealand, I sort of a Slavic family, so you know, it's pretty tough sometimes. And men aren't meant to be emotional; they certainly aren't meant to cry, and that's the way I was brought up. So anyway, fast forward to 1994, and I was actually the group behind Arnold Palmer. I think he played with Mark. Was it John Mahaffey? And anyway,
yes, it was John Mahaffey.
Yep. And so, you know, I finished fairly quickly and I'm in the locker room. It was hot as hell. And the story, the reason why Oakmont was so important too to Arnold Palmer, and also why it's going to be his last event, was his father desperately wanted to be the head pro at Oakmont and he never got that position. So when Palmer lost to Nicklaus in 1962, it was really hard on him, because that really is his backyard. So, you know, I knew all the background about that, but I didn't think much about it at that time. So I finished and I'm just waiting there trying to drink some fluids. And the TV comes up, you know, in the locker room, and it's, you know, Mr. Palmer had walked into the press center. And the first thing he did, he got a standing ovation, number one. And the first thing he did, or first thing he said, was thank you, just to the media, because they'd covered him, because this was his last US Open. And I think he took a breath, he had a towel wrapped around his head, and he talked, he did the rest of the interview, but there were tears coming out of his eyes. And I'm like, that's a man's man, and he's crying. And I learned for the first time in my life, it's actually okay to cry. I mean, it seems really weird. I learned a lot of lessons from Mr. Palmer. I told you I got to play with him first round at Augusta, the first Masters I ever played, and I learned from him. And then to see at the end of his career, and then obviously I got to see him when I was at Golf Channel because he would always pop in, and then at Bay Hill. But I'll never forget that. I think he validated a lot of things that we sometimes think incorrectly when we're a kid growing up. Biggest lesson I've had in my life, that I'll never forget it. And I think that's also why people were drawn to him so much, because he was real. He had a great laugh. He could tell a story, spin a yarn, and he could cry. He was a bit like Jim Valvano, you know, laugh a little, love a little, cry a little. That's a pretty good person.
Yeah, it is. Frank, before I let you go, remind our listeners again, how can they stay up to date with all the things you're doing, whether they're following you online, watching you on TV, or on social media as well?
Well, I mean, I don't tweet that much, but it's like frank_noveloke.com. But more importantly, as you've been nice enough in the past, you know, we have a foundation, the Noveloke Foundation. My wife is the driving force behind that. We try and take underprivileged kids shopping around Christmas time in Florida. And I'm proud of what we do, but more importantly, you know, the amount of work she puts into that. So that's the biggest thing, just helping your own community. That's good enough for me. Yeah.
So let everybody know, how can they contribute? Because it's out there and available. You've got a nice website. How can they contribute to the cause?
Yeah, if you go to thenoveloefoundation.com, you'll see a lot of different things there that you can do, or come and play, or help us with the shopping. We need volunteers. But like I said, just even in your own community, I think that's, you don't even have to be part of, jump on board with us. I think it's trying to do more in your own community. But if you live in Orlando or Florida, then jump on board. We'd love to have you. So you'll see what to do on the website. Yeah. Chris, Frank, thank you.
No, thank you. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to come back and be a part of the show. When I know you're about to be on, it's always something that I look forward to. Can't wait for the night to get here. So I can't thank you enough for all you've meant to me over the years.
No, well, in a few days' time, take a really deep breath because I know there's going to be a lot of candles. Make sure you blow them all out.
Good advice. Cheers. Take care, my friend. All the best to you and your family. I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Frank. That is the great Frank Nabilo, folks. And please go out there and look online and get to be a part of the Frank Nabilo Foundation. If you're in Orlando or anywhere around the state of Florida, it's a great foundation doing great things for kids. And that tells you who Frank Nabilo is, by the way. I think if you really were to spend some time and talk to Frank and ask him about his life, he was a fantastic golfer, right? You don't finish in the top four in all four majors for no reason. He transitioned into being one of the all-time great broadcasters. And look, I've always loved the Masters. You guys know that. I watch it every year. I've been on property every year since 2001. But when Frank made the transition over to CBS and become a part of that broadcast team, he made that broadcast infinitely better. And he did so by the way that he goes about commentating about what we're watching. He doesn't tell us the obvious thing. He doesn't tell us the guy's about to take a shot, the guy's about to make a putt, whatever it is. We can see those things with our eyes. What Frank does is he lets you see the game of golf through a golfer's eyes because he was one of the top golfers on the planet. And look, as great a golfer as he was, as great a commentator as he is a 10 times better person. That tells you more about who Frank Nabilo is. I think he would tell you it is way more important to him to be great in the community and great to other people than it ever was to be a golfer or an analyst nowadays. So I'm just so thrilled that I've become as friendly with Frank as I have over the last several years. Just a wonderful individual and a guy who has now been on the show for a seventh time. And he means just the world to me. He's been very, very good to me. And I hopefully get the privilege of catching up with him a little bit later on in the golf season. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this edition of Next on the Tee. My sincere thanks to four great guests and people who joined me tonight. Owen Brown, John Patrick, Hal Sutton, and Frank Nabilo. Scheduled to join me next week are Tom Patry will be back. Top instructor and former tour player Larry Rinker will also be back, as will PGA Tour caddy Kip Henley. And a young lady who was named by Golf Digest as one of the best young teachers in America, Eva Rogers, will be making her second appearance on the show as well. So it's going to be a spirited show. I hope you'll come back and be a part of it with us. Quick reminder that you can find this show available as a podcast just about anywhere you get your podcast content. But in particular, we're on the Pittsburgh Tribune Review site. Just go to triblive.com and click on sports. And right there, you're going to find the most recent episode of the show. If you click on sports and then podcast, you'll be able to stream or download any of the shows from this season as well. You can also find this show out on places like Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audio Boom, and Player.fm. And as always, my thanks to the folks over at Good Pods for making this show one of their recommended podcasts. So please download their free app and stream your favorite podcast right there on your favorite device. But as always, most of all, my sincere thanks to all of you for being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. I appreciate each and every one of you so very much. Until next week, hit 'em straight, my friends.